Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and I'm here with Dr. Julian Keith and Dr. Len Leche of Mars Memory Health Network. We're talking today about Alzheimer's disease in 2015, what new research is revealing about the causes of the disease and the impact of lifestyle changes. Have you served as the caretaker of a loved one with the disease? Tell us about it by calling 910-343-1138 or send an email to us at coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us using coastlinehqr. And we have an email from a listener who says, how much stock do you put in the idea that participating in activities such as crossword puzzles and other brain teasers can function as preventative measures for Alzheimer's? And this is an interesting question because both of you, Julian Keith and Len Leche, probably know that there is a national underwriter of NPR that, you know, we constantly hear those underwriting promotions about brain training programs. Are those effective, and are crossword puzzles just as effective? Julian Keith.
When there have been studies that show that when used in conjunction with other lifestyle changes, there can be benefits. Used alone, probably not much. The study that I'm thinking of was one that was done in Finland, and they had a large number of people randomly assigned to be either in a group that underwent a pretty extensive lifestyle change or a group that continued their lifestyle with just some health advice. They included in that study cognitive training, so computerized cognitive training like your underwriter provides. And they found very large benefits, very nice protective effects. But they also had people change their diets. So they went to more of the Mediterranean-style diet with nuts and oils and plant-based and low-carbohydrate-based diets. They had them exercise physically. They taught them stress reduction strategies. So they taught them to meditate and to practice relaxation skills. All of those combined dramatically decreased the risk that they would develop Alzheimer's. So,
is there a measurable difference? Do you know? And a listener actually asked me this question a year or so ago, and I looked around to see if there had been, you know, any sort of general reporting on this. And I think USA Today had published an article that said, at this point, researchers are debating the merits of these brain training programs. But so far, it looks like crossword puzzles are just as effective. Len Leche?
Well, I think that's important to note is that if, you know, we're talking about this in the context of Alzheimer's, and there's very little evidence to suggest that these are going to be your cure for Alzheimer's or that these alone will make a fundamental impact on these disorders. Where there have been some published studies showing their improvement are things like processing speed. So people do seem to get better at that. They definitely get better at those games. So kind of within that domain. There's actually been one study that came out that suggested they do a little better in their day-to-day functioning also when they perform in these. Actually impacting the memory domain, that's been one of the weakest effects. So if you think about it specifically for something like Alzheimer's where the primary symptom is memory, you wouldn't necessarily think these approaches would be the best since that's the one area that they probably seem to have shown the least amount of benefit on their own. But I think, you know, what Julian was getting at is what's critical is having mental engagement. Forcing your brain to do new things. I mean, we do know that, you know, your brain is producing new neurons all the time, but to keep them alive, you've got to challenge them to do different things. So if you're always doing the same thing, so you mentioned crossword puzzles, you know, one might imagine that if a crossword puzzle gets easy for you and it's something you always do and you're having fun at it, at that level, it's probably not stretching you. And so, you know, trying to do something very different is likely to have more benefit for you. Now, if you've never done a crossword puzzle, the effect, at least initially, might be a little more effective for you. So it's really about challenging the brain to learn new things.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about Alzheimer's, what we know about it now, why screening is important. If you have a question or an experience you'd like to share, give us a call, 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Holly from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you, Holly?
Doing great, thanks.
Tell us your question. Do you have a question?
My question has to do with the possible genetics of Alzheimer's, and is it hereditary from parent to child or grandparent to child, whatever the case may be? And given that you talked earlier about being able to change some of those things by having proper diet and exercising your body and those kinds of things, can you change that heredity if it is in fact genetic, and that, which brings me into sort of the discussion of epigenetics, genetics, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Julian Keith.
Oh, that's such a great question. That's fantastic. So there is a heritable component to Alzheimer's, particularly with the form of Alzheimer's that has an early onset that you see people in their late 50s, or actually even sometimes their 40s, 50s, early 60s, showing evidence of. And that form of Alzheimer's is rapidly progressing, and there are clear genetic markers for that, and it's highly heritable. That doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to get it if you have a relative who has it, but it means that the chances are increased. It's also likely that the later onset dementias or Alzheimer's has a heritable component as well. But
it's likely, but we don't know that yet.
We don't know as much about it. It is likely. But the question of whether that risk is modifiable through particular kinds of lifestyle interventions seems to be pretty well answered. It does look like, even if there's a heritable component, that you can decrease the likelihood of getting it by making certain lifestyle changes. You can control those risks with diet, with exercise, with learning to manage stress. The epigenetic component, now that gets pretty deep. Looking at how the activation states of genes are controlled by things like experiences with stress and other life experiences, and whether or not those are transmittable across generations. So epigenetics is we used to always think that all the genes that we came into this world with were in a particular state, and they were not modifiable. And the discoveries in the field of epigenetics or in the domain of epigenetics show that you can actually change states of genes. And in some cases, those genes seem to be transferred across generations.
You can change the state of the genes that you inherit.
Exactly. So the best studies on this that I know of were done in mothers who were stressed and passed along genetic markers of having experienced that stress in the states of genes that were transmitted to their offspring. And so you can see markers of stress responsivity, too, in the offspring of mothers who were stressed. And so those kinds of things are going to be very important in our understanding of all of these kinds of diseases in the future.
Len Leachy.
And also just to point out, because I think one of the heart of the question that was being asked might be, you know, the sort of fatalistic component. So I've sort of got this genetic marker. Am I doomed? And I think it's really important for us to recognize that is absolutely not the case. Not just as Julian mentioned, But also the case that we have the sort of the famous 2007 Rush study where, you know, at autopsy you see people that have all the sort of internal markings of dementia, the Alzheimer's type, the tangles, the plaques, but they never really manifested the outward signs of it.
You're talking about things that somebody doing an autopsy would have found inside the brain.
Exactly. Okay. And so sort of the classic signs that these people really should have had dementia, the Alzheimer's type, but they didn't manifest those behaviors. And so one of the things that tells us is there's still this sort of missing link, if you will, from what's happening in the brain to these sort of functional symptoms we see in day-to-day life. And the truth is, I think while the genetics might end up resulting in those problems in the brain, in the end, whether you have those functional symptoms, there are additional steps. That's not an automatic, even if you have, you know, some of the strongest genetic predisposing factors, it does not mean you will manifest those outward symptoms. And for all of us, I would think, that's the most important thing. It's basically your functional ability. If at autopsy they say, wow, you actually had an Alzheimer's brain, if you were able to live a good, healthy life and not really experience those consequences, that's the most important thing. And so kind of speaking to that, I think the concerns that the listener, the caller was mentioning, it's absolutely not a done deal in terms of that last step of manifesting the functional problems in day-to-day life.
Holly, thanks so much for your call. When you're talking about amyloids and tangles in the brain, is that something that can be tested for just from a physical standpoint, not a cognitive impairment standpoint, before someone passes?
The beta amyloid is the target of a lot of investigation now, and people are developing techniques to be able to use neuroimaging to see it. There's actually an effort right now to quantify it in the retina. So you can actually scan people's eyes and get a pretty good indication of how much beta amyloid there is in the brain. So there's a company right now trying to get that approved by the FDA.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about Alzheimer's research, lifestyle changes that could impact Alzheimer's in a patient. If you have a question for our guests or if you have an experience you'd like to share, give us a call, 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org or tweet us using coastlinehqr. Catherine, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hello there. My sister just died a year ago of frontal lobe dementia.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you. And it came on like gangbusters. The last 6 months, it just went really quickly. And when I saw her, she was walking fast back and forth, very thin and energetic. And then she bumped her leg. They put her in a wheelchair, then she wouldn't get up. We tried to get her up, and the brain was telling the foot not to work. And I did aromatherapy on her with frankincense and myrrh and some lavender to relax her and stop some of her agitation. And that really helped, and some foot reflexology helped, and hand therapy. And then she wasn't eating. She'd just been eating fruit, and it was hard to get food in her mouth, so I got little mini morsels, little real chocolate morsels, and I pinged them in between her lips. And the endorphins in the chocolate seemed to give her some energy, and she lifted her head up, and I saw some spark in her eye. So I just wanted to pass that along.
Catherine,
that might help.
That's so interesting. Julie and Keith Lenlechi, have there been any studies on alternative kinds of therapies to treat people with this kind of dementia?
Yeah, well, first, I wouldn't mind speaking to the frontotemporal dementia part. That's a particularly challenging situation, and I think the caller showed tremendous compassion and innovativeness and care. For her sister, that's beautiful in itself. Frontotemporal dementia involves changes in personality and rapid changes in functional abilities, like as she described. As for alternative treatments, I think most of what we know from the alternative world comes from anecdotes, as the caller just gave. She connected with her sister. She comforted her. she was able to get her to enjoy some things, some odors and taste and being touched. Those things, I think, are very powerful. I mean, that's basic human contact. And I don't know if there's any evidence that they produced, you know, dramatic changes in the course of the disease. But I wish that everyone who had frontotemporal dementia had someone loving them the way the caller apparently loved her sister.
Catherine, thanks so much for your call. Len Leachy.
And, you know, one other thing to note when you are talking about the frontotemporal or FTD, frontotemporal dementia, often the course is different than we see with Alzheimer's. It usually advances quickly, and it also onset tends to be a little younger. The other issue that tends to come up is there's often misdiagnoses. It can appear very psychiatric. I heard Catherine give the description of a little more sometimes energetic, disinhibited sort of behavior. And so oftentimes because it's not diagnosed, it's not caught. Alzheimer's in some respects is easier to diagnose in the sense that at least the traditional case, you know, you sort of have a particular age group, the sort of classic forgetting. With the FTD, there's oftentimes that misdiagnosis, and it appears very psychiatric in its presentation.
What role does psychiatric or psychological health play in the progression of the disease? Does the level of happiness or adjustment in one's life have anything to do with this? Can it advance or slow down the progression? Len Leachy.
Great question. You know, there's a couple of ways to come at this. One is from the standpoint of risk factors. So again, among the risk factors are certainly things like stress, depression, anxiety. Those things can be risk factors for onset of cognitive problems. So certainly treating those or avoiding those problems decreases your chances. But the other aspect of this as well is even at the level of detection. So we'll take depression as an example. When people do come to the clinic, for example, we do assess them for depression, as oftentimes with particularly more moderate to severe depression, you can have some significant memory problems that occur, but they are typically for a different reason. So the memory difficulties that occur with depression, again, are more in the inattentive component, not true memory loss, information that was attained that gets lost over time. And so, again, on the surface, a lot of these clients come in and they are complaining of memory problems, but oftentimes it's depression and it's a different type of memory difficulty that they're having, the sort of inattention. And so those are always important things to sort of separate out, both as factors for causing and sometimes some confusion, if you will, at the diagnostic level as well.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Drs. Len Leachy and Julian Keith from UNCW and Mars Memory Health Network about Alzheimer's disease, risk factors, lifestyle changes. If you have a question for our experts or a story that you'd like to share about your experience with a loved one in Alzheimer's, give us a call, 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And we have a listener who's emailed this question: do you foresee any different healthcare models in the future that will ensure care for those that get dementia or Alzheimer's? The insurance is so expensive right now that for many it is prohibitive. I myself am having a hard time deciding whether to break my bank with monthly high payments for long-term healthcare insurance. Len Leachy.
Yeah, you know, obviously that is one of the biggest. I mean, we heard some of the numbers at the outset. So it is an expensive disease. You know, Alzheimer's oftentimes doesn't kill you. You're likely to live with it for quite some time. And so it has a high toll, if you will, cost-wise because of its durability. You might be dealing with this disease for 15, 20 years, and then the amount of support that is needed by the patient. Alternative options, we do have a lot of resources that are available in the community. Alzheimer's North Carolina is the nonprofit. We have an office right here in Wilmington. And that is certainly something we hope that everyone who has a family member that they're dealing with that has that disease would avail themselves of these free resources that are there. They do workshops for caregivers.
Tell me again the name of that nonprofit.
It's Alzheimer's North Carolina. And you can find them on the web, and they're here locally, and there's full-time staff to help individuals.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Drs. Len Leche and Julian Keith about memory health, new research on Alzheimer's disease. You can ask a question of our guests by calling 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. This is Coastline.